What's going on, everyone? I am back today having another kick-ass conversation with David Bloom. David is a journalist, fellow podcaster, professor, and consultant who focuses on the collision of Hollywood and tech. He's a contributing writer for Forbes magazine, TubeFilter.com, and Next TV. David and I get into a great discussion about the complexity and everything that is going on in the streaming wars. We then dive into the influence of YouTube and podcasts on Hollywood, and how brands are shifting away from traditional advertising and pivoting towards branded sponsorship. Finally, we talk about the future of content, and David explains what is the metaverse and how very shortly it will be in all of our content. Enjoy the show.
This is the Thought Leaders Podcast.
Before we begin today's episode, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to our Thought Leaders newsletter. As always, I love bringing you guys the best and brightest content creators, and we have some amazing folks here in-house at Thought Leaders. Our amazing analysts are bringing you something special each and every week in the newsletter. This week's issue is our Pride issue, coming this Thursday. We're showcasing how the LGBTQ community is shaping influencer content in big ways. It's going to be an especially colorful edition. Our team lives in Tel Aviv, widely considered the epicenter of some of the biggest pride parades and celebrations in the world. We can't celebrate the normal way this year, of course, so we're celebrating virtually. So sign up for our newsletter at www.thoughtleaders.io/newsletter. That's thoughtleaders.io/newsletter.
This is the Thought Leaders Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of the Thought Leaders Podcast. I am joined by Mr. David Bloom, who is a sensational and phenomenal author, journalist, podcast host, you name it, he's doing it. How you doing, David?
I am okay. Awake and functioning in the middle of a pandemic, a few local riots, things like that. It's been an interesting few weeks.
Okay, well, regardless of the situation, you look very cheery and great for what's going on, and I'm really happy to have you on today. Before we start, I would love if you can tell our listeners who is David Bloom.
I am a longtime journalist. I've also been a communications executive at USC's Business School and at MGM. These days, I write for a variety of publications, Forbes, TV Rev, which follows the this transition into streaming from traditional TV and what all that means. I write a weekly column for TubeFilter, which is big in the influencer and influencer marketing space, and another site called Next TV, which is born of the multi-channel news and a couple of other publications. It's their online site focused on streaming. So I spend a lot of time in the streaming space writing about it. I have a podcast called Bloom in Tech. I do a lot of conferences and panels. These days, they're all virtual, so that's been an interesting experience. And I write about a wide variety of things. I also do a little bit of consulting and to try and help companies figure out where they're going and what they're doing and all this transition that is transforming Hollywood and so much else.
Okay, wow. So that is a lot to digest, and we will break it down bit by bit. So I would love if you can start kind of with the streaming wars and what's going on with there, and your takes on, you know, a quick outline of what's going on, especially with the HBO Max stuff coming out this week.
Right. Well, HBO Max actually launched a week ago on the 25th of May. And I think that it was a little confusing for a lot of folks. It's like, how is HBO Max different than HBO or HBO Go or HBO Now? And it is actually quite good. I got on it. My spouse subscribes to HBO through the old school pay TV bundle. And so you were automatically upgraded. You just had to go and do it. So poked through there, did the authentication stuff. And there's a ton of stuff there, much beyond even the fantastic library of classic HBO shows, current and library content. There's a lot of other things. You know, films from the Criterion collection of the greatest films of all time, a wonderful collection of Charlie Chaplin movies. They've got stuff from Studio Ghibli, which is Hayao Miyazaki's extraordinary Oscar-winning animated films. They've got a bunch of other things. They've got a bunch of TV shows, including Friends and The Big Bang Theory, which for people who binge those shows, inexplicably to me, but who binge those shows now, they are there for them in profusion. Beyond that, they have a lot of other stuff, you know, a bunch of movies you'd like, the DC movies, some of the Batman things and stuff like that. What's interesting is to kind of think about what's there and what's not. I mean, they often, they have things like a bunch of Ingmar Bergman films and Rossellini and Antonioni, you know, the Italian New Wave films. They have Breathless, the fantastic French New Wave film from 61 or whatever it was. I'm a bit of a film geek, among other things. And so it's lovely to see some of those available in a really accessible interface. But more importantly, it is a major new player that I think is partly to blame for forcing Apple to change its TV Plus strategy, which originally they launched in November. And their strategy was, we're just going to do originals only. Then we're going to take everybody else's content and kind of part it out and put it on there too. And you can access everybody through us and we'll make money mostly by selling everybody else's channels and then aggregating it all here, making it easy for you to find the good stuff, right? And what's happened is, this is a big change. They were being what's called a channel store. Amazon's been making billions of dollars a year doing that exact same thing. And Roku makes a lot of money off of it too. Basically, you come in for their basic service and then they do add-ons. And you pay for those add-ons and they scrape 30% or whatever it is off the top for the subscription fee to make it easy for you to have it all in one place. That's under assault because HBO Max didn't want that to happen to its content. It spent a lot of money to build this beautiful interface and they want to own the customer. They want to own all the revenue. They want to have that whole experience there. They want to own all the data about all those customers and their credit card numbers and all that stuff. And so they said, no, we're not going to do that. So it's not on Roku. It's not on Amazon. Apple's on it, but you go to Apple and it sends you over to the app. So it's kind of an interesting fight there. It's going to be changing, I think, the way we access this stuff. We really wanted to have something that was a little bit like the old school pay TV package, right? You go, you're stuck going to Spectrum or Comcast, or maybe you can go to DirecTV and they have 50 or 100 or 150 channels, and you can add on HBO and you can add on Showtime, but basically it all goes through them. It's all one place, one pay, one sign on. That's it. We're not going to have that in these streaming wars. And they are just now picking up with HBO Max coming out. We still got Comcast still has to fully launch Peacock, which will be July 15th. It's already available for free to people who pay for broadband through Comcast. That's another gigantic service with lots and lots of stuff on it. And so all of a sudden we've got several big chunks of content in different little spaces, and how we connect to them is going to be a real pain in the rear. And how we figure that out is a company I wrote about this week called Packet Media that's still trying to build a separate, you know, everybody can sign in through here and you can control all this stuff and you can get bundles. They're trying to solve that problem. I think other companies are too. But we're getting out of the pay TV business that we knew. 2 million people have cut the cord this year. Last year was a record when 1 million people cut it for the entire year. Already, wow. 2 million plus have cut it. And it's just that pay TV business is collapsing and we're all moving over to streaming and record speed. And that's changing the way Hollywood's going to work, because all of a sudden they're not just making stuff and then putting it in theaters and not knowing who's watching it and then putting it into you know, home entertainment channels and selling DVDs through Blockbuster or whomever, selling it to Netflix, and Netflix knows who the customer is. Now they're going to know who the customer is. They're going to have to build a brand that people care about. And it's a very different experience. They're going from business to business to business to consumer. And that's a very different thing for Hollywood. So it's a huge change. And we'll see more consolidation, I think, because of what's happening. I think Apple's going to buy probably some libraries at some point. So they've got a library. They don't have one. To compete with these giant libraries that Warner Media has and Comcast has with NBC Universal and that Disney has. You can also see a difference with Disney, its approach. It's not one service, it's three services. So there's ESPN Plus for sports, whatever's left of that right now. I mean, I don't know how they're making any money off of that, right?
I think the UFC stuff and people are really kind of coming for that. but
yeah, that's about what's left.
Yeah.
If you don't like UFC, like I played football, I played basketball, I ran track, I played baseball. I love sports. I don't give a flip about UFC or boxing. So it's like, there's nothing there for me. Right. And, yeah. You know, people talking about what the NFL season would be like if we have the NFL season, it's like, okay, you know, or stuff like that. It's like, I'm not going to pay $5 a month for that. But then there's Hulu. And then there's Disney Plus, which is really great if you're an Avengers fan, if you're a Pixar fan, if you're a Star Wars fan, or you're 4 years old. Right. But it ain't so great for grownups who don't have kids to mollify, right? And that's not a knock on people who like the Avengers. I mean, the Avengers are great, and it's all fine. Yeah. But I mean, I have a sort of a limited appetite for how much of that stuff I can consume. So enjoy The Mandalorian a lot, but you know, I'll be okay not having Disney Plus. I mean, they've got a bunch of shows about behind the scenes at Disney. It just feels a little meta to me. You know, it's like a Disney show about behind the scenes at Disney is like really for just a hardcore fan base. But so they're trying to get like beyond their sort of focus too. But they're basically three companies or three different logins, three different consumer bases and all that stuff. And you can buy a bundle, but you can't just go in and get all of that stuff, sports, Hulu and all that Hulu has, which is includes some interesting stuff from FX and FXX, you know, grown up programming and edgier stuff, things that would never be on Disney Plus. And then there's Disney Plus. So that's a very different model. So we'll see how this all plays out. It's a really fascinating time, though. And amid all this, we've got a pandemic that's closed American theaters, changing theatrical exhibition. We've got now we have some riots to make things more complicated. On top of that, we've got a big shift in we've got contracts being negotiated with the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild with Hollywood to figure out, you know, how people get paid for stuff between the pandemic and the shifts that are happening in theatrical stuff and everything else that's going on. It's really going to be an interesting time in Hollywood and see, you know, who gets paid, how they get paid, who's doing the paying. So it's a fascinating time.
Yeah, I know a lot of what you write about is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is Hollywood and tech, correct?
Yeah, I like to call it the collision of entertainment, technology, and media.
Okay,
so
I'm looking back at the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, and to me, the two biggest changes, or three biggest changes, or threats to traditional Hollywood, I would say would be one, the streaming services. That's the latest and greatest. But a little bit before that, I really believe that YouTube and podcasts definitely had this massive effect on Hollywood. Do you share that thought?
Well, I would definitely separate what YouTube is and what podcasts are. I would say that two things. One, YouTube created a whole generation of influencers, online influencers. And they're the ones that still are the biggest source of monetization for people who create their own content, build their own audience, generate revenue from a variety of sources beyond the advertising shares that YouTube enables. But it started with YouTube. They still are the biggest payer. And what happens is these folks, by force of some talent, implacable willingness to be on camera and to create and have a personality and do things and be creative on a routine basis, and then to take care of an audience, have managed to make, in some cases, very nice careers. And, you know, that, you know, YouTube gets a lot of credit for that. Now we have a bunch of channels that do a lot of stuff. So now there's a whole new set of influencers called live streamers, and they do things like on Instagram Live. Instagram is its own thing, but Instagram Live is, it's a different thing to be able to do like our conversation, but in a live setting without benefit of, oh, let's edit that out, or, ooh, let's put some funny production tricks on it, you know, or it's a little noise, you know, some little stingers in audio or whatever, you know, it's just a, they can carry it out. And of course on Twitch, which is owned by Amazon, that started out really gamer focused, and they have lots of ways for their personalities to make money, but that's a particular skill, like being a talk show host, but one who can also play a very involved video game and carry on with a fast streaming chat room window and be entertaining. I mean, to be able to do that all live is insane. And I'll do it for hours at a time every day. I've interviewed guys like Ninja, the biggest name probably in the space, and he spends an inordinate amount of time on air, but he's also built a real business. He's got books out. He's got a record label with putting out music to Game By with a Capitol Records label, one of their labels. He's got, his hands in all kinds of things. And a bunch of these other guys are being very clever. And you're seeing esports teams like FaZe Clan and 100 Thieves and Immortals and Team Liquid who are building a new set of stars. That's all completely separate from Hollywood. It has nothing to do with Hollywood, except Hollywood's going, oh, there's a whole bunch of young people who are doing this and have some talent. So we have people like Lily Singh returning into like talk show hosts. But there's also a whole bunch of audiences we can't reach with traditional advertising. We can't reach with our traditional linear TV programming. And so that's been a huge shift. And now what we're seeing during the pandemic is a bunch of established stars like John Krasinski or John Legend or Dean Ice, the musician, who are using social media to connect with fans and build relationships and build new kinds of programs that the kids have been doing for a while. Right. When you were a big Hollywood star, why would you use Zoom or why would you use Instagram Live to connect with people? But now you don't have a choice. You know, you're bored. You got to do something. You got to connect with your people. I don't think that's going to change. We've just shrunk this whole, transformation and pushed it into a whole different set of audiences who are like, oh, I can watch some good news with John Krasinski. Or you could. He had 8 episodes and they ended up selling it to Viacom, actually. Viacom CBS, but things are coming out of this that are being created by traditional media using the non-traditional means, and it's sort of smearing, and all of a sudden they have control over their destiny and their audiences in ways they didn't when they were working through a studio. So that's a really interesting transformation. The podcast business is one of those things like esports that I call a 20-year overnight sensation. You know, it's taken forever.
By the way, I really, really like that. A 20-night over year sensation. It makes a lot of sense. But please explain to those who don't get what you're saying.
Well, I mean, esports has been going on since the late 1990s. Podcasts in a significant way took off when it was going on beforehand, but when Apple launched the iPod, which is also about 20 years now, the podcast came from iPod, right? It was audio. It was something to have on there that Apple didn't have to pay a royalty fee for, right? It just had created this directory. You could access the people that were podcasting back in the day, these OG podcasters. And all of a sudden, over the last couple of years, it's really taken off as money has come in because they've come to understand that it can be more than just you and me talking. It can be audio theater. It can be documentary style stuff. It can tell stories in more audacious and sophisticated and ambitious ways. And what's happened is money has come in to finance the creation of fiction or documentary style podcasts that then could be used, if they can find an audience, to become programming in more traditional Hollywood circles. So Homecoming, which is now in its second season with HBO, its first season was Julia Roberts, started out as a podcast. Dirty John, another show that's, I think, on Netflix, started out first actually as a LA Times print series, then became a podcast, and now has become a show. You know, the Betty Broderick Murders, I think, is what it's called. Dirty John, the Betty Broderick Murders. So, it's becoming this place where you can try out stories and you can build audiences and pre-market something, and then for fairly low cost, and then get it before millions of people, and then take it out to a much more expensive, streaming production. It's not going to end up on broadcast TV because no one's going to be putting cool new stuff on broadcast anymore. They just aren't. It's going to be live sports and news. So,
okay. So I think you touched on some really cool points there, and in my head, what kept coming back to me is I'm thinking of Marilyn Monroe, and I'll tell you why. Because here she was. And where was she from originally? Middle America, right? Somewhere. Right. Okay.
She's out of Hollywood. I want to say Iowa, but I don't think it's right. Yeah, but she was a Midwestern girl, if I recall.
Midwestern girl come to Hollywood over the course of a few years, or maybe even a little quicker. Overnight success, you know, almost completely due to Playboy and Hollywood. Today, you can be that Marilyn Monroe overnight success from your basement, doing whatever it is you want on the internet. Does that devalue Hollywood? And if so, or if not, how is Hollywood grappling with that?
Well, I don't know that it necessarily devalues Hollywood, but it certainly decentralizes Hollywood. So it's less central. I mean, and it pains me to make this reference, but just look at Kim Kardashian, who did a sex tape as opposed to a Playboy centerfold, used that and some of her family's existing notoriety through the O.J. Simpson trial that her father was an attorney in, and you know, Bruce now, God, I can't remember her current name, Ms. Jenner's name, but you know, that family had notoriety before she came along, but she used a sex tape to get to be more than just a Paris Hilton pal. And then has leveraged that into the reality show and into all kinds of spinoff programming and being married to crazy but talented, you know, Kanye West and all this all the self-inflicted drama that has brought. And you know, but she didn't need Hollywood to get started.
Right.
And she has worked in and around that system and leveraged everything that system has, she and her family, in very smart ways. But she's the most obvious of a very long list of folks. Hollywood still matters, and the agencies still matter, because they're a place where there's a lot of talent, there's a lot of creative people, but there's also a lot of money, distribution channels, marketing relationships, and ability to take something and make it much bigger. They can be an amplifier and a talent aggregator, and so it still matters, but it just isn't the only way anymore. So and beyond that, we have, you know, new kinds of, I mean, Netflix, you know, buys amazing amounts of incredible programming from around the world now. It's not just coming from, you know, 20 miles from my house right here in Santa Monica, California. It's coming from great TV shows out of Israel and out of Denmark, and amazing serial show, I mean, great movies out of South Korea and India, and, you know, on and on and on, all over the world. So people are getting a chance to see stuff from a lot of places that aren't Hollywood now. And it used to be the only people who saw that were the ones within about 5 miles of an art house theater in about 20 big cities around the country. They might have 2 weeks to see, I don't know, some famous film by a great Italian or Indian director, and it was gone. So, you know, at best, 100,000 people might see one of those movies. Now, 190 people in 190 countries and 180 million subscribers have a chance to see those movies. So it's a very different thing, and it's not all Hollywood. Hollywood's still there, still matters, but it's not the only way. So.
Okay, I'm thinking Parasite. I don't know if Parasite happens, or at least the you know, the recognition that it got 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago, right?
Though that actually came through. I think the openness to even consider a foreign film. I mean, look, the big swing that Netflix took the previous year with Roma, Alfonso Cuarón's beautiful film. You know, Cuarón was really interested. He said, why didn't you put this out in movies? So, you know, he got a little short theatrical run in about, you know, 150 theaters because of the way that the theater business works. They don't want to help Netflix or these other online streamers because they see it as a threat to their industry. But, you know, they spent a lot of money, maybe $60 million, probably double what the film cost to make, to market it for the Oscars 2 years ago. And it ended up winning three. It just didn't win Best Picture. I think it did win Best Director. And it's a beautiful, beautiful film. But people ask Cuarón why he didn't want to have it in theaters, because it's the sort of thing that would be gorgeous on a big screen.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a stunning film. But he said, look, you know, this is a film in Spanish and Mixtec you know, a native Mexican and language about a maid set in 1971 in Mexico City in black and white. How many people would go see this in a traditional release, right?
Especially other movies that are, what, 20 bucks?
Yeah. Yeah, they're 20, yeah, it's 15, 20 bucks to go see it in any theater that would carry it, right? So instead, he gets it out there, and at that point, they had 150 million subscribers, you know? But 150 million subscribers around the world saw that film, boom. In one moment, they push a button, and 150 million people can look at it, and it got watched. You know, they don't put out a lot of viewership data at Netflix publicly. Right. But it got watched, and it did win 3 Oscars. It just didn't win Best Picture. But I think it paved the way for Parasite, for Hollywood to say, yes, it's time. In fact, probably because Netflix was involved, there were some old fogies who hate Netflix because they see it as a threat as opposed to a new opportunity, and probably voted against Roma that year, but were okay doing it for Neon, the distributor behind, the little indie distributor behind Parasite, the next year. And to recognize that film, because it wasn't a year of a clear-cut favorite. Like, Roma was really the best film the year before. It was really the one that's like, yeah, that's really it. But I think there was some sort of blowback. But that being said, Netflix helped pave that way. And so we got Parasite this year. And as Bong Joon-ho said, you know, don't let that little 1 inch of type across the bottom of the screen keep you from seeing this entire world of amazing film. And he's right. You know, there's so many great things out there. And now we can see them in ways that we couldn't before. My wife and I were watching Fellini's 8½ on HBO Max last night. That's a classic film. It's completely inscrutable to normal human beings, but it's a really gorgeous, amazing, long, fascinating, you know, influential film. And just hit a button and there it is. And bam, it's fantastic. And you can stop when you want to and go to the bathroom and all those things. And it's great. So.
So I'm a big proponent of YouTube, and I always think that some people minimize YouTube's influence on us. And you were touching on the point of instant access, and I can click a button and all of a sudden I have something. And I think that the streaming wars, or all streaming sites, definitely come from that, our desire to have that. And I do think that YouTube kind of was a pioneer in that, where for the first time ever, you're able to get whatever content you want. YouTube has varying degrees of quality, but whatever you want from anywhere you want. Do you think that there is that trend that came out of YouTube?
Well, it certainly was a pioneer in that. I mean, you know, it was notorious back in the early days for being the home of videos of surfing squirrels.
And it was, that's true.
You know, and it was diminished for that by many folks, but they sort of missed the point, because now it's this extraordinary repository of all kinds of things that you wouldn't expect to find, you know, videos of, you know, 1970 Oscar presentations or speeches or, you know, classes on how to do anything, you know,
literally
how
anything.
To videos, literally anything. Yes. And, you know, it's this extraordinary repository. I mean, people don't know that, you know, the largest search engine in the world is Google. The second largest search engine in the world is YouTube.
That I didn't know.
So that tells you how much is going through there. It's a gigantic revenue center for Google as well. I think the number I saw was something like $15 billion a year. It's an estimate. They don't break it out separately, but there have been estimates as much as $15 billion a year in ad revenue. That's a big business, just for stuff that people put up for free. You know, the music business lives and dies off of its YouTube presence, so much so that they created Vevo with the big record labels as a place to centralize some of that stuff. But, you know, there's endless amounts of other music on there, and the discovery in so many other areas, it's created all these things. The challenge is, though, that you have to program yourself, and some of that's great. And they're pretty good about creating these playlists that suggest some things, but it tends to be, you know, some downsides of the way that that happens. The algorithms aren't perfect in terms of suggesting stuff. There are some people that say that, you know, it tends to give you more of the same stuff. So you can go down a rabbit hole of sort of you know, for instance, in terms of radicalizing people with extreme positions, you see the one sort of fairly mild thing, and then they show the next thing and the next thing, and it gets, it's like they turn up the heat on this, on the frog in the, in the, in the water till they're boiling, right? And it gets, that's the problem with the playlist. So you can find the thing you want to watch, but then you have to find the next thing and the next thing, and how well they give us other stuff that we want to look at is their supreme challenge. So, you know, if you want to like reprogram stuff every 5 minutes, you could do that, but it's not very relaxing.
Yeah.
You know,
Definitely that is not something that I think I want to, or anyone wants to do. Speaking right. of the influence of YouTube on streaming services, I believe I read something you wrote, or I definitely just seen a piece out there, how the streaming services are definitely incorporating the shorter 25 minute kind of mini docuseries onto the platforms that I think draws a lot of inspiration from YouTube. What do you think about that?
Well, there's a couple things going on. You're right. As far as it goes, there's certainly plenty of capacity for what I like to call short attention span theater. You know, and that includes docs, that includes news related stuff. Not everything needs to be a 2 hour Fred Wiseman, you know, PBS documentary that takes 4 years to capture hundreds of hours of video about some institution and then break it into, you know, this compelling but deep portrait of how an institution doesn't work or does. Sometimes you just need 5 minutes to tell a story, and that's all it takes. And the thing is that we didn't have outlets 20 years ago for that. There wasn't a structure in TV or film to really do that. You know, there was no, those older structures weren't set up for the 5 minute piece. Like, what do you do with that? You know, it's like you do that, and then what do you do for the rest of the half hour of your programming block, right? Well, now a story is as long as it needs to be. It can be 3 minutes, it can be 50 minutes, it can be 2 hours, or it can be Shoah, you know, which is a 9 hour documentary, a landmark documentary about the Holocaust. But it could be any of those things. And so there's this whole, I'm being photobombed by my spouse.
It's okay. Please. While at home, or definitely.
Yeah.
Everyone happens to everybody.
Yeah. I usually get around it by where, if I'm on Zoom, I've got this virtual background stuff.
No, this is good. This is real. This is relatable. This is why people tune in.
Exactly. But I think the other thing that we're seeing is, you know, one of the other services that launched and not in a rather so-so fashion was Quibi, which was focused on short form.
I was about to bring that up. So, yeah.
Yeah. Focused on short form, focused on mobile. I think they made some strategic mistakes, and they also had a really bad bit of luck when their scheduled launch. They raised $1.75 billion, a lot of money for a startup. They've got all these short form things or long form things that are purposely broken up into 10 minute pieces. And the thesis was people want to watch stuff in little snippets because that's the time they have. So 7 to 10 minutes is what we're going to do. And we're going to have it so you can look at it vertically or horizontally with this turnstile interface that we've created.
According to the news, by the way.
Yes, there is a company that says, you know, this looks an awful lot like our thing. We'd like to get paid for it. But there's a long history of Hollywood doing that. But beyond that, I mean, go back to, you know, Apple and Microsoft suing each other over interface things, and Samsung and Apple suing each other over, you know, iPhone and design, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, they came up with a short form approach, and they made some strategic mistakes, and they got hammered by the fact that all of a sudden people didn't want to spend 10 minutes looking at their phone while they're at the grocery store. They were at home, they were looking at bigger screens, and they wanted something to be on there for longer. And they didn't have a way to take it from your phone. They purposely did not allow you to throw it to your bigger screens and watch the whole film. Mm-hmm. Instead, you'd have to watch it in 10 minute pieces. And it's like, it made sense for the world they were creating Quibi for last year. It didn't make sense when the pandemic hit. So they've had only, I think, a couple of million downloads, and they're retooling and they're giving people the ability to throw the stuff onto a bigger screen. But we'll see how that plays out. They've got a pretty hefty content burn and a so-so initial consumer response. So it's going to be a challenge for them. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think again they really launched at a very, very tough time. So I do wish them.
It could be a great time, but the product they have is wrong for the time. That's the real thing. Plus, they made some strategic mistakes, I think. So mm-hmm. You know, I'll give you an idea with the other one. I always forget about it, but you know, we've just been talking about how important social media and creators are and how they can help drive all kinds of things. Well, one of the things you don't do is make it impossible for somebody to say, hey, I like this show. I'm going to do a screen grab and then put it up on Twitter to talk about that show. So all of a sudden the show gets a little bit of free publicity when it gets shared out and other people see it and say, oh, I'll check it out too. Yeah. They didn't allow that. They killed any organic reach possibility, which is the dumbest self-inflicted wound you can imagine. It's the sort of thing grandpa does when he's doing, you know, creating something for the kids, right? It's like he doesn't think that social media matters. Well, I don't want to call Jeffrey Katzenberg grandpa, but it's like, dude, what were you thinking?
Speaking of social media and kind of circling back to YouTube, you're doing a lot of things with influencer marketing, correct?
Yeah.
Can you kind of walk me through how you got started with that entire vertical and what your thoughts are on the whole industry?
Well, I knew there was a lot of stuff going on. I did some consulting in social media spaces coming out of the Great Recession, the last time we had a big financial challenge. I did some consulting because I knew that what was happening with SEO and social media was really important for companies as much as it was for the individuals who were creating stuff. So I had some early learning and training and predisposition toward tracking this, and ended up writing about it some when I was at Deadline, which is an insider publication, online publication here in Hollywood. I helped them out on a bunch of stuff, including their social media strategy. But was doing writing because I actually understood all this stuff and because of my own background for decades going back as a journalist in various places. And then continued to started writing a column for TubeFilter after I left Deadline, talking about, again, this collision of media technology and entertainment, but with an influencer focus. And you can't avoid the crazy stuff that's going on, not crazy, it's remarkable stuff that's going on in influencers and their interactions with brands, because you talked about YouTube being the start of where they make money, but YouTube's monetization is modest. It's something, it's definitely important. It's a foundational chunk of the money that these folks make, but it ain't enough to pay for them and their people. You know, when they get bigger and they've got to be on multiple platforms and they've got to do all these other things and they've got to recut stuff and they've got to, you know, they've got to figure out other ways to do this. So there's been this whole infrastructure that's built up of management teams and cross-platform tools that allow you to put something out here, and here, and do in different ways, and just to extract snippets from this thing and turn them into something that can run over here on, like, you know, Instagram, and you know, all that stuff is emerged. And then on top of that, the brands have said these are huge audiences we can't reach, so we need help doing it. So agencies have been created that help them do that, attract the best and most effective creators for a specific area, and you know, help them all get engaged. And now even people with relatively tiny followings of a few thousand, so-called nano influencers, have some value to brands who might hire or do some sort of deal with hundreds of them at a time for a big rollout of a product or a marketing campaign. So that's a really significant thing. And you're seeing money flowing into that slowly, but significantly flowing from other older sources like TV, traditional TV, that's going into things like influencer marketing because they can reach an audience they couldn't reach before. So it's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. So do you actually think that brands are spending less on traditional, let's say Hollywood TV ads, and more on the influencer marketing, or they're just spending more overall and putting that into influencer marketing?
Well, right now they're spending less overall. I mean, that's the problem. A lot of companies in the middle of the pandemic pulled back significantly, even in the digital space, enough that, you know, I did a one-on-one as part of a Zoom webinar 3-4 weeks ago with the guy who's the co-founder and president of Studio 71, for instance. And Studio 71 is a big online, they represent about 600 influencers in their deals and all that. And they also create all kinds of content for traditional and the online sites of various sorts. And he said, you know, the good news is we're getting a lot more viewership. The bad news is the money that's coming in is there's less coming in to the, there's more viewers, but less money coming in because advertisers don't have the money. So it's being cut more away. So it's like a double whammy. So we're having more views and less money. And we're having to figure out new ways to produce stuff. So that's been interesting too. They've had to do some really creative stuff to get around it. I'm hearing that from lots of folks. And it's a big challenge, no doubt about it. But you know that, I love this line that McKinsey, the big consulting firm, came out with and said that basically what we've done is pack 5 years of digital transformation into about 8 weeks of pandemic lockdown. That all of a sudden, your mother or your grandmother knows how to Zoom. Your father or your grandfather is asking about how to get into games online. You know, stuff that never, ever would have happened is happening, this uptake of people. I mean, and again, it goes back to things like, you know, the big Hollywood stars who didn't need to worry about online stuff are now going, oh, I can directly have a relationship with this audience. I can build this thing that has value. I can use that to leverage other things. I can take advantage of the relationships I already have and the goodwill I already have as a performer and do this. And they weren't going to do it before, and now they are. And so it's not going back. Brands are pulling money away from traditional TV and they're putting it into places where they can reach people where they are and to know in a much more assertive way that they've actually reached them. And increasingly they call it, this is an issue called attribution. They can attribute better sales directly to these connections. So they're getting better at that attribution question too. So
yeah, I was actually about to bring that up. Do you think, and I know in TV there are certain ways to track your results, but I know in the YouTube and podcast world, direct response, you know, you can track exactly how many people clicked on that YouTuber that said 10% below. You can click, you can know when they're clicking, where they're clicking, right, how much they're buying.
How, what platform, what time of day, what their gender, where they were when they bought it. Yeah, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a famous line, I think it was John Wanamaker who was the name owner of a famous department store in Philadelphia. And he said, you know, I know I waste 50% of my advertising budget. I just don't know which half. And that was the line for 120 years of the ad business. And then all of a sudden, the promise of this online space is that you will know so much more about who's buying and how they're buying. And still not perfect. It's not a perfect science, but it's much more perfect than what TV has, which is we're going to send out an ad to reach 3 million people who are more likely to be of this demographic than that demographic, because that's what Nielsen says based on some studies it does of, you know, 20,000 little surveys that it then extrapolates to the entire U.S. population. So we think that that all connects to this. And we're going to sit down all those people and hope that some of them buy our pickup truck. And we know that we sell more pickup trucks when we advertise more. So that must work. Yeah. Well, that's one way to think about it. Or you could say, I'm going to send a deal directly to, I'm a local truck and car dealer at the Ford dealership in here. And I'm going to send stuff to a specific group of people of a specific demographic who are within 10 miles of my place and give them a deal on this truck. And let them customize it and order it and then hit the button and it's done. And I know that that person, I reached the exact person I needed to reach who's going to buy that. And I know whether it works or not, and I can tweak it and change it for very little money and do it again and again and again. So that's a whole different dynamic than what TV has to offer. It's like a gigantic shotgun or blunderbuss versus this, you know, sniper rifle. And the blunderbuss can work at short range. If you shoot wide enough, you'll hit enough targets, but it's expensive, but it's a whole business. The other thing is it's a gigantic industry. It's having to go through radical change. And again, that's going to be accelerated. Once again, it's another thing that's accelerating in the middle of all this stuff. So,
so how is Hollywood and traditional TV linear TV, how are they competing with these direct response campaigns on YouTube and podcasts and things like that?
Well, there, this was going to be the last great year for TV advertising. It's about a, in an election year and an Olympic year, it's about a $21 billion a year business. And in an off year, it's about a $19 billion business. And it's been pretty flat in that little sort of oscillation. It's like a sine wave, right? Been pretty flat like that over the last few years. This was going to be the last probably pretty good year, because we had an election where Trump alone was going to spend well over $1 billion. But lots of other people were going to spend lots and lots of money too. And a lot of that was going to be anticipated to be for TV. We were going to have the Olympics, which is always a big deal leading up to it, even though it's the biggest thing is for NBC and its, you know, satellite cable channels. It was going to be big for a lot of other folks too, because the advertisers sort of buckle up and do that. Well, the Olympics are delayed. No one wants to hear about politics any more than we already are in the middle of all the stuff that's going on. And more importantly, people are getting out of the cable packages. They're not subscribing to cable TV. So it probably won't be a $21 billion business this year. And they're having to shift. The broadcaster's big response is they're rolling out as rapidly as they can a new generation of broadcast technology called the standards are called ATSC, which is a standard setting body 3.0. And it basically allows them to send out to have five times the bandwidth usage, up to five channels. Well, actually much more than that, but a bunch more channels for an individual broadcaster. They can have data services on there. It's interactive. You can go back and forth. You can send something out. It's addressable, which means that, again, you can send an ad out, but it'll only go, the specific ad will only go to the households that are in this broad demographic that have opted in. So the pickup ad example I mentioned, they could send it to males within these zip codes of our broadcast area, over 25. They could do that under the ATSC 3.0. They rolled out for the first time a couple weeks ago in Las Vegas, four stations switched over to these new broadcasting things, and that gives them a chance to do something. I don't know that it'll be enough. I kind of doubt it will be enough. But if you are getting out of the cable bundle, you can have a pretty good mix of a digital over-the-air channel or antenna that brings in these local digital broadcasting things, plus whatever you're streaming for the big dollar shows. So you get the local news when, say, your city's on fire, and you get, or the local college team is playing football or whatever. And you get Hulu and Netflix, and you can do that for less. And it's a pretty good package of entertainment at that point. You can do that for less than you were paying for all, you know, 200 channels, 197 of which you didn't watch. Right. So that's their hope. That's their hero, you know, move to try to survive. And we'll see how it works. It'll be an interesting shift. You need to have new equipment, new receivers. It could work where you can get TV in your phone with these chips, but it's a bit of a Hail Mary.
Okay.
At this point.
Speaking of the future and where things are going, something that I have definitely read that you have been putting out some very, very cool stuff is the metaverse that you have been discussing. So I would love if you can walk me through that for those who aren't familiar with the term and what it means?
Sure. It kept coming up a lot in the conversations in the last few weeks for good reasons. One is that, let's just start. The metaverse, in all your spare time here in the pandemic lockdown and the riot curfews and all that, pull up early William Gibson, pull up Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, pull up Ready Player One from, was it Ernest Cline, I think is his name. And those are sort of seminal science fiction books talking about this notion of a three-dimensional virtual space that users can help create. Companies are there, experiences are there, the detritus and flotsam and jetsam of pop culture is everywhere. And people are making livings off of this stuff. It's like taking virtual reality, crossing it with a lot of the experiences we see now in games like Fortnite and Minecraft, where you see in Roblox, where people are creating these things, but then pulling them together in a three-dimensional spaces that you can traverse and move between things. You can have your NFL Marvel jersey skin expression of yourself and go from game to research center to banking to whatever. That's the grand vision. Companies, people like Tim Sweeney, who's the founder of Epic Games, which created Fortnite, have been very explicit about trying to take Fortnite in that direction. And you see it most recently with several things they did that move beyond what Fortnite is, which is a game where you shoot at people and then you get into the room lobby and you talk about it with your friends. It's become a social media conversation space as much as it's a socializing space, as much as it is about the game itself, where losing isn't that big a deal because 99 people out of every 100 who play lose, right? Everyone's a loser. No one feels bad about it. Like the one guy who wins has hit the jackpot. And maybe he's really good. Maybe he got lucky that time, but you know, usually he's pretty good. So, but the fact that it was free, that it was on every platform, that you could play across those platforms and you could talk with your friends meant that it was this thing that has now been taken up by 350 million users. It's not the only one. There's a bunch of others. Warzone from Call of Duty took off, but that's very focused more on the game experience as opposed to the communications part. And the thing that Fortnite did that was really interesting is they just did a deal a year and a half ago. They did a thing with Marshmello, the EDM guy, and had him play for 10 minutes and had 10 million people show up. It's like, holy crap. You know, the all the conferences I was at a year and a half ago, you know, in the panels I was doing then at those conferences, people are like, this is a big deal. And it's like, yes, it was, but they didn't really like replicate that for a while. They did a bunch of really really interesting
show up. I think that some people who are not familiar with Fortnite don't really know that. I just want to actually tell them what that is.
Okay, well, Fortnite is a video game, came out of it's coming up on 3 years now, I guess. It's a game where...
I meant that when you say people showed up, what does that mean? They actually showed up in the game?
They came into the game and they actually basically created a safe space where no one gets to shoot or build things in this meadow. And for 10 minutes, Marshmello performed, but 10 million people showed up simultaneously to watch that. And that was like a holy crap moment. And then
so they got 10 million people. It's just mind blowing to me. 10 million people to a game where they're shooting people to not shoot people and watch a digital concert, which they could go onto any other. They could YouTube, iTunes, and watch this. Not the same thing, but to listen to the music, which is mind blowing.
Exactly. So what they did though, now they doubled down and they created. First, they had Travis Scott, who's a big hip hop star, come and do a series of 5 concerts in different parts of the globe. They were timed at different parts of the globe, sort of prime time in Europe, prime time in Asia, prime time in the US. It's a series of 5 concerts of his new single, Astronomical. That was a big hit. They even created things like backdrops that were good for Zoom to help promote the thing, which was really smart because I used it in some of the conversations I was going to say, look, this is really interesting. But they were also selling, you know, in-game things like skins that were suggested by some of the visual art, because it's not him, it's his virtual avatar who's doing the performance. I think it was mapped with motion capture or something, but it was the virtual version of Travis Scott in the game with a lot of extraordinary effects and all that. So that was cool. Again, they had 12.3 million people peak watching at one time, but something like 110 million people watched over the five concerts at some piece of the five concerts. But then they opened this area called Party Royale, because it's called a Battle Royale style game. They opened a Party Royale island that has, where they now have like really prominent musicians perform on a regular basis. People like Diplo and Dylan Francis and folks like that have performed there. They have an aerial obstacle course. They have a company store to sell things. And they have a few other odds and ends. I'm sure they will come up with more stuff because they're pretty inventive over there. And all of a sudden, this is a place where you can't shoot and you can't. The part of the game is building up stuff to protect you, that you harvest resources and you build up things to protect you or whatever, or create obstacles. And part of it is you shoot people. You gather loot and gear and guns and you shoot people. And it's a fun game. It's very well done. And they keep the fun. We've got all kinds of brands doing, you know, branded skins that get sold within the game that help promote stuff. It's really smart about what they're doing. But this Party Royale area suggests that evolution for Fortnite and for other sites. Now we see Minecraft being used. My son went to Berkeley. Somebody in this year's class made a brick for brick recreation of the entire Berkeley campus, and they held their graduation. The university held their graduation this year in at Minecraft, which is another game, recreation of the entire Berkeley campus, which is big. They had a lot of time. Those guys had a lot of time in
life. They're going to Berkeley, so they're smart kids.
Yeah, and now they're doing concerts in Minecraft as well. Again, this becomes, it goes from a game and the things that a game does, which includes this social component, includes graphic sophistication, it includes tools that people can use to create their own spaces, and take all those things and pull it beyond games into a broader context, like music, like street apparel, sneaker collections, all those kinds of things start to become enabled within these spaces, which is why these become the place it starts, but not the place where it ends. So it's a really a fascinating thing to watch. And again, got accelerated because all of a sudden a bunch of people were sitting in Zoom rooms going, this is okay, but I'd like a little more interesting experience when I'm in my communal conference room. So you see, you know, programs like House Party, and there's a new one out of London called TEOH, T-E-E-O-H. I've seen some stories on it. Basically takes The Sims and makes it into a meeting space. Another guy that I interviewed recently named Sam Engelbart has invested in a company whose name escapes me, but it basically uses distance within a space to create different areas to, like, you get closer to these guys, you can talk to them. Your representative is really just a dot. It's simplistic visually, but you move closer to these guys, you can hear them. You move over to these guys, those guys fade out and you can hear these guys. So it's sort of like if you're in a cocktail party, you're in different parts of the room, and they do it for like their staff meetings every day, he said, but they also do a Friday night DJ space where they have different DJs sprinkled around this larger space, and you go and listen like you're at Coachella. You go to the stage A or stage B, and stage A fades out while you're listening to stage B. As you move around, it's really fascinating stuff. So we're seeing a lot of interesting innovation in the ways that we interact virtually, and more and more and more of us are having to do it. And that's the point. And we'll see more innovation there, and we'll layer new kinds of experiences on top. And then we're going to start moving toward that metaverse thing. So,
okay. That is scary and reassuring all at the same time. I think there's a lot to look forward to. So in conclusion, I guess we can say that the way we consume entertainment today is going to be drastically different than it will be in 2-3 years down the line. Would you agree?
I would say that the way we consume entertainment today is drastically different than it was three months ago. And let's just say that more change is coming at us very rapidly.
Okay. So I like that.
Just think how different it is now versus what you were doing 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Try to walk that forward and go, oof, okay. I've got to write a story about where things are going to be in about 18 months. And I see a lot of breadcrumbs on that trail, but boy, I sure don't see an obvious, this is where we'll be in 18 months. I mean, it's just changing so fast. So
well, that's exciting, I think.
It is. If you're not being ground under the wheels of progress, it's absolutely exciting.
Okay. Thank you so much, David. This was a pleasure. And again, thank you so much for joining me. And
you bet. Had a good time.
This is the Thought Leaders Podcast.
All right, everybody. That is another episode in the books. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us your comments and reviews, and new episodes will be coming out every Monday. So until then, have an awesome week.
This is the Thought Leaders Podcast.